Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds, the associate producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. On Wednesday, February 26th, Joe was joined by Stuart Rice Honorary Chair at the University of Massachusetts Amherst College of Information and Computer Sciences and Faculty Associate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University, Fran Berman, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin, and semi-retired editor-at-large, columnist, editorial writer for the Times Union, Jay Jochnowitz.
So here's what happened. The House Republicans narrowly approved a framework Tuesday for President Donald Trump's legislative agenda. This was back and forth. They didn't know whether they were going to have the votes or not, and they got it by a whisker. And it sets off a sprint with the Senate to reshape the tax code, implement strict new immigration policy, drill for new energy resources, and spend billions on national defense. The vote, 217 to 215, would allow Congress's GOP majorities to bypass a Democratic Senate filibuster, though what's known as the budget reconciliation process, but Republicans still face significant challenges before they can pass what Trump has taken to calling his big, beautiful bill. The House and Senate must agree on competing approaches, even though both chambers have now passed their own version of the legislation. Some tensions within the GOP were on display Tuesday. Conservative hardliners and moderates alike threatened to buck Speaker Mike Johnson and sink the budget. Moderates fear its $2 trillion in spending cuts will force the GOP to slash Medicaid benefits, a political third rail in toss-up districts. But hardliners say budget cuts don't go far enough. The Senate has already passed its own budget resolution under the assumption that House Republicans would falter. Democrats were united against the bill and attempted to thwart a GOP head fake over it. Republicans acted as though they planned to postpone the vote after a lengthy negotiation with a quartet of holdouts. As Democrats left the chamber for the night, the GOP called up the measure again, forcing the minority to rush back. Two Democratic members, Kevin Mullen of California and Brittany Pedersen of Colorado, whom the GOP did not expect to be in attendance, emerged from hideouts to cast critical votes. I think we've proven to the Senate and to everybody that with President Trump's support and with a good product and working together, we can achieve anything, said the House Budget Committee Chairman Jody Arrington of Texas. I think that small majority forces you to work together. That from the Washington Post, this from Bob Griffin.
So I have a different name for this. It's the rapid raping of revenue is actually what we should be calling what occurred last night. You know, part of the bait and switch, and you may have heard a heavy sigh, sort of these high school parliamentary games,
yeah.
They are not reading the population correctly. I mean, the House and Congress, because there is very little stomach for this type of garbage right now. What happened last night really is a bill that is designed to camouflage and hide where the cuts are really going to come from. So the language that they used was that they directed cuts from each of the subcommittees. So rather than being truthful and saying, listen, we're going to cut Medicaid, they said that we're requiring a cut of $880 million from energy and commerce. Okay, but energy and commerce, if you're going to get that type of money, you have to cut Medicaid. If you look at some of the other areas, they're going to have to cut SNAP. Which is the food program for children and poor. They're going to have to be looking at agricultural subsidies. So they are not being truthful with the American people. They are also not being truthful to the fact that they are cutting, they voted to cut budgets that are part of the direct network of benefits that keep people alive in order to give tax breaks back to the very, very wealthy. And you know, you use the, what was the figure you used, Joe? Was it $2 trillion in spending cuts? But in reality, with this and the tax cuts, you know, you're starting to look at adding in the next 10 years $11.25 trillion more to the deficit. This is an emptying of the public coffers for the good of the 1%. And if you wonder who the 1% are, go back to inauguration, look at the oligarchs that were standing on stage, and every one of them benefits from this. And everyone who is not on that stage, including the four of us on the show, will be paying the freight for them to have even more money. And I think one of the things that infuriates me the most, Joe, is that I want to remind members of Congress, and including people like Mike Lawler, who, find your spine, Mike. You just screwed over your district. It's our money. Okay, they're treating this like, you know, well, we're making these cuts. You know, we don't want the, you know, we're cutting these services. And I know they're playing this game about efficiencies, but in reality, this is money that you took from us as part of the taxing program, and now you're taking from us again to redistribute to the incredibly wealthy.
Fran Berman.
Oh geez,
it was so good that you were
just a moment of silence for those.
This will be
lost.
One of the 17 times that I don't hang up because I love you all so much. let's see. I think the bill is very consistent with what I'm hearing from the adolescents in the White House and Congress. We like rich people. We don't like poor people. Let's get rid of those programs that help poor people, because honestly, we don't like them and they just muck up everything. We don't like diversity. We don't like immigrants. We don't like universities. So, you know, let's just get rid of anything that would make life easier for any of those folks. Apparently, we care about fraud. As defined narrowly by whoever's around, we don't care about debt, though. So, you know, if all of this fraud is supposed to help us balance the books, we don't care about that. So we like loyalty. Loyalty is good. Not to the flag, not to the Constitution, but, you know, loyalty to elected individuals and unelected individuals. So I don't know. I mean, that message has been consistent and clear, you know, ever since the world changed. And, like, this is another example of, you know, how that message is being delivered.
Jay.
There's a lot, a lot to unpack. I think one of the first things that could be done with this, that the, you know, if the Democrats are looking for something to do, is explain what the New York Times explained very clearly, and to keep hammering home on this point, that the tax benefits of this bill will be greater, not just in terms of dollars. You know, when you give rich people a tax cut, it's by its nature going to be bigger than mine. I, you know, kind of accept that. But as a percentage, it's going to be bigger, too. So that's not fair. And I think people, when that is explained to them, can understand that, you know, and grasp onto that. And it's a simple message that ought to be hammered home, that this is a, as you said, you know, this is a raping of the federal revenue. And the idea that they're going to be taking away, you know, what they have to take away to achieve this is important. You know, a lot of people like to think Medicaid, and I think it was talked about in either the Washington Post or the Times story, someone said these are not just welfare people, which is, you know, a cold way of putting it. But if that's your if that's going to be your attack on the bill, well, okay. But it is. It's going to be, you're going to see cuts in breakfasts for kids, school lunches. You probably, I think Musk in his crazy, one of his crazy moments floated the idea that kids should have to do some sort of work in exchange for their food subsidies at school. You're going to see, and I think this may well jump over into Medicare, which I said to my wife the other day with a word that I can't use on the air. I said, if you mess around with old people, you're going to find out that we're not as old as we look. we're not talking octogenarians here. You're talking about, you know, people in their 60s and 70s who don't want to have, say, the $2,000 cap that Biden achieved on their drugs taken away. Trump has talked about getting rid of that, from what I understand. So, you know, this is, or at least thrown it out in one of his many word salads.
We're talking about the House narrowly passing a budget bill yesterday, a big, beautiful bill, as the president has called it and is calling it. And whether it stays, I'm assuming it'll always stay big, whether it still stays beautiful or not in the president's eyes is another question mark. Is there anything else you wanted to say?
Yeah, there's a couple of things. Just to kind of close the loop on the children in particular, the Times did some nice breakdowns of this, what each committee has been assigned and how much they have to cut and how much spending there is. And on the child nutrition and student aid category, the amount they have to work with is $722 billion. The amount they have to cut is $330 billion. That's half, give or take, 40%, somewhere in there. That's an astounding amount of money to have to cut from any program in government. You know, when they talk about, like, you know, you have to do a 5% cut, a 10% cut, they struggle to do that. But to say you've got to do a 40% cut, well, you know, kids are gonna go hungry. And students are going to be screwed in the process. The other thing that leaped out at me, two things that leaped out at me with this package were, one is that they have $562 billion in cuts that haven't even been assigned to a committee. It's just like, well, we'll also do that much to make the package work, you know. But and the fiscal hawks went along with this. There are, and they're going to increase along with the tax cuts that they're talking about, $100 billion in military spending for the biggest by far military in the world, the most expensive military in the world in any case. And I guess what I'm left with is, how does this do anything to generate jobs, and how does this do anything to generate to lower prices, which I thought were two of the biggest issues around.
Can I dig into the Medicaid issues just for a second, too? Because my theory, and I've seen this from a couple of other sources, is that the targeting of Medicaid is because of the population it serves, that it serves the truly underprivileged and children, and therefore they don't have the political voice. And the reason that they're not talking Medicare cuts right now is because the going after the elders is a third rail. Mm-hmm. So again, this is another example of an absolutely morally bankrupt Congress. I mean, think about what we're talking about. We're talking about giving the very wealthiest more money to go buy their yachts. And we're willing to let children starve in this country. Now, I know the GOP will keep them in their thoughts and prayers because, you know, anytime, you know, we see children getting shot in schools, that's their only answer. So now that as we start to see students or children starving to death, I'm sure that's going to be their response. But there should be outrage everywhere in this country over what this is, over what this budget and this pathway is going to do to us as a society, and the idea that we would knowingly let people suffer in this country in order to continue to overinflate the budget for our the quote national security is just an anathema to everything that we stand for.
I mean, Fran, I think you made the point first, and it's a really good one about it does show about what they don't care about. And it certainly seems.
Yeah, I mean, and by the way, I think adolescents are great. We were all adolescents, and our kids were all adolescents. But adolescence is not known as a time when one makes the most measured and thoughtful decisions. I mean, that's not true for a lot of adolescents, but it's you know, somewhat true in general. So no knock on adolescents. I love you all. In fact, I teach many of you in my classes.
yes,
I loved the expression, Fran. I thought adolescents in the White House just summed it up beautifully. There's a lot of other adjectives you could use, but...
Yeah, but this is a family show, so yeah. You know, the other thing I think, and this is another thing I would ask the listeners to correct me on the correct definition is, you just see us sort of sliding into all of the characteristics we think of as a third world country, right? You think about crumbling infrastructure. You think about disrespect for the neediest and poorest and most in need of services, parts of the populace. You see dramatic gaps between those who do the best and those who do the worst. And my question is, you know, how fast are we going to get there? And stuff like this, no. It's hard to imagine human beings being so thoughtless about one another. All of what I do for a living and all of a lot of what I care about is the public good. And to see the public good so tattered and so inconsequential in all of these decisions. And that's not to say these aren't really hard decisions. A lot of times, all of the time, we have these competing priorities. But we should be able to trust, in part, the public sector to promote the public good. It's not the job of the private sector. It's not really anybody else's mainstream job, but it is the public sector's job. And so, I don't know, like a lot of the listeners, I haven't figured out exactly beyond the things I'm already doing what more dramatic thing I can do, but it's pretty heartbreaking. And if there are any listeners that don't wake up and read the news and aren't depressed every day, you know, we should hear from them because maybe they have some things to share with the rest of us.
That was Fran Berman on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, February 26. We'll be back with more after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, February 27th, Joe was joined by communications expert and founder president of Stanhope Partners, Bob Bellafiore, Senior Fellow for Health Policy at the Empire Center for Public Policy, Bill Hammond, a grants analyst based in Albany, Emily Honan, and investment banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman.
Later on this morning, Trump said he and Zelensky would use a hastily arranged meeting at the White House on Friday to finalize a mineral compact that his administration has pushed on Kyiv as Washington tries to broker a swift end to the war with Russia on terms that could be favorable to Ukraine. Trump voiced his desire to end the fighting, which 3 years after Russian President Vladimir Putin's full-scale invasion has killed and wounded hundreds of thousands of people on both sides. My number one thing is to get that stopped. My number two thing is I don't want to have any pay any more money, Trump told reporters, referencing the billions of dollars the Biden administration granted to Ukraine during the war. Now we're going to be betting all, be getting all of that money back, plus a lot more. The president's meeting at the White House represents a crucial juncture for Ukraine as the Trump administration, marking a major shift in U.S. policy, launches a peace process with the Kremlin, and Trump embraces chief aspects of Putin's justification for his 2022 invasion. Bob Bellafiore.
Well, I think I pledged on the first time I was on the show. By the way, it's not so much that people come back; it's that they get invited back, which I think is the key test. the first time I was on, that I wouldn't mention the guy's name because it triggers too many people in the listening area. So I will try to get back to that. I won't mention the guy. I'll just call him the guy. The guy is making it very clear, I think, to Europe and everybody else that they can't take the United States for granted anymore. If you look at public opinion polling, there was a poll that the New York Times and Ipsos did in January before the guy was sworn in. 60% of the American public said we should pay less problems to overseas and concentrate on our problems at home. 38% said we should be active in world affairs. He is making it clear that that the days of what the public might see as unfettered, unrestricted, and unmonitored support for foreign countries is no longer free, and you can't take it for granted. And that's, you know, that's a strong message. Everybody, lots of people early this month were upset that Zelensky wasn't at the table. Zelensky probably should have been at the table, but negotiations are a process. And the process gets rolled out in a strategic sequence that that you might not always see when the thing starts out. So having Zelensky at the table, having Zelensky come to the White House this week is the next step in that process. But I think the key message is don't take our support for granted. You've got to bone up. And I think that's his message to Europe on NATO. And I think that's his message to that'll eventually be his message maybe in the Far East. And that's a message the American people will get behind.
I think the listeners can handle that. I'm going to call him Donald Trump. But
in this context, can we just call him the Don? Because I think the shakedown that's afoot, I worry that White House meeting is going to look as despicable as, if the reports are true, the meeting with the Treasury Secretary looked like in Ukraine.
So I want to get to that, and we'll have you up next, Mark. Just a quick follow-up for Bob, which is, you know, these negotiations, and you call it a process, and I understand that, but through that process, the President of the United States has also called Zelensky a dictator and said that that Ukraine was the aggressor in the war that just celebrated its third-year anniversary. That can't help things during that process.
Well, you can't blame Trump for that. I mean, he's seen all those very credible videos on X, you know, like, you know, of like the celebrities visiting Ukraine that we totally paid for, that totally weren't paid for by Russian activists. But it's okay because he dismantled the agency that handles that kind of messaging. So,
you are angry. Good. Excellent.
I think the part that of what Bob said that I would disagree with is whether the American people are going to get behind this, because it's one thing when you're talking in the abstract about how Europe needs to carry its own weight. It's another thing when you're talking about a country that's being pillaged by a dictator. That is the American understanding of what's happening in Ukraine, and I don't think it's wrong, right? Like that's actually what's happening. And now you have Trump very visibly bullying the victim in the battle. Now, maybe he'll work his magic and his base will swing behind that point of view. It seems like he's getting some help from X, but it's just hard to take. It's hard to watch. And the one saving grace is that Zelensky is such an effective communicator.
Yes.
He is like it's almost miraculous how well he's able, as somebody who didn't come up in politics and then got thrown into this impossible situation, he will know, or I'm expecting him to know how to play Trump and more importantly how to play to the public when they come out of this meeting.
Well, like the other guy in the room on Friday, he's a TV guy. I mean, yes, he didn't grow up in politics. He was a stand-up comic.
Yeah.
Okay, so he certainly understands what it's like to be in front of a microphone, to be in front of an audience, how to deliver a message, how to be effective, and so does the other guy. So it'll be a fascinating dynamic. But if there's one thing I learned from watching and being in politics for, dare I say, 40 years, is that even when you're on the inside, it's hard to see what the plan is. And you may not realize what the next move is. It's right. It is a chess game. And I know that you want to call him a shakedown artist and people want to think that he's a moron, but he's not.
I don't think he's a moron. I just don't think he has any kind of chess game going on. I think he moves very instinctually.
I think he is a moron.
Mark?
Oh, I have a question for Bob. Bob, what set of negotiations that we've seen has Donald Trump done a good job?
I think he's got Zelensky coming to the White House now.
That's an accomplishment because
I'm going to say that the process is moving along. There are countries in Europe that are now stepping up to say we're going to have more support for NATO. We're going to step up and defend Ukraine. He's, you know, delivering a message that that it can't be, that the American support can't be taken for granted, and he's moving forward on it. It's not over yet. So I'm willing to see how it ends up instead of freaking out in the middle of the third inning of a 9-inning game.
Yeah, I'm going to freak out.
Because you don't like the guy.
No.
You think he's a moron.
Nope. I don't think he's a moron. The fact that I don't like him isn't relevant to my assessment of what's happened so far. So, and what Donald Trump is doing that I think are a series of profound mistakes. First of all, let's just look at the basics of the negotiation. So the Secretary of State of the most powerful country on the planet was put forward in a meeting with his counterpart from a nation with about $10 billion in GDP and about, what, fifth or sixth on the world's population list. And what did we get for that, for starting to legitimize Russia? Oh, we got nothing. What should have we gotten? At least what I would call a warm ceasefire, where you sign ceasefire agreements, people don't keep to it, but at least they're only lobbing grenades out of their trenches as opposed to leaving the trenches. So right off the bat, he's made profound mistakes. And if you look, I was trying to think this morning, like, to your point, why don't I like what's going on? Is it just because I hate Trump? It's because what he is valuing publicly are things that are ephemeral. And what he is publicly selling out or abandoning are things that are true. So let's go through the list. This rare earth minerals deal is a joke. Why is it a joke? Because 40% of those rare earth minerals are in territory that's currently controlled by the Soviet Union. The rest of it are speculative deposits that have been not assessed by typical standards in the mining industry. So we really don't know what's there. It's a suspicion. Beyond that, the true value of rare earth minerals and the processing is not in the mining, but it's in the sorting of the ore, the process of basically taking the dirt and putting it somewhere. So what's Donald Trump signing up for? He's signing up for this deal that he claims he has all this value. And the one thing we know about the deal is he has no idea if there's any value there. But he's going to sell it to the American public because he wants to look good and he wants to emphasize the optics. He's also talking about business opportunities in Russia and Ukraine and how that's going to tie us. The Ukrainians should have some sense of security because, hey, if we've got business interests there, we'll certainly stand up for the Ukrainians. Give me a break. How did that work last time? We not only did we turn tail, but we decided, rightfully so, because of our moral obligation not to fund the Russian war machine, that we would remove our businesses from Russia. So to say that that is somehow part of a deal. Also, he's saying what he wants to do is end the war. He's a fool in that sense. Vladimir Putin sees this peace deal as a step in continuing the war, allowing Putin and Russia to reload and continue his military endeavors, probably in Ukraine, perhaps in other places in Europe. So again, we've got Donald Trump saying, I want to end the war. We've got the other guy who's smart enough to realize this is just a step on what he wants to accomplish. What else is Donald Trump foregrounded that's ridiculous? Oh, do we need to go to
a break?
Okay.
I've cleared the decks for you, Mark. So you're on fire. I'm not stopping this.
Well, but he's saying it's okay. The Europeans are going to provide an effective security guarantee, and the United States may or may not backstop it. Again, it's nonsense. The British can't even muster but one brigade. The Europeans on their own will do one of two things. They will die in Ukraine if Russia takes exception to them at some later date, or they will be supported by the United States. So effectively, there is no security guarantee unless the United States puts forward a security guarantee. You and I are going to agree very quickly that Europe should not be in this position. But the other ephemeral thing is that Trump is saying, I'm solving this by teaching the Europeans a lesson by showing that I'm not going to support them. Again, it's a fallacy. That lesson is a lesson that they're going to have to come to terms with over at least a decade, probably longer. So the illusion that today's pronouncement in Europe solves the problem is nonsense. It's going to take them a decade even to have the targeting abilities that they now rely on the United States for. So what's Trump selling out in respect for this? He's selling out respect for an alliance and respect of a leadership and a people in Ukraine that have provided an incredible service for the world and the United States by providing a firebreak against Putin's intentions. Because if anybody thinks that if he'd gotten to Kyiv and finished them off, that he'd have stopped, I think they're not looking at history very carefully. He's also looking at, he's also saying, well, you know, we're not really dependent on the stability of Europe in this I don't want to 38% of the United States is only interested in getting involved and the rest doesn't. Again, it's nonsense. If Europe is overrun, we will be involved. Every dollar spent in Ukraine was a good investment on stopping the problem then and there. And so, you know, this fact about, well, we've spent X hundred billion dollars, this was a cheap way to put a firebreak in front of a guy that needed a firebreak. The other thing I will say, and this is a much bigger topic beyond today's show, but I take even exception to the premise that whereas we have a country that has historically shown itself with territorial aspirations, basically as soon as it gets the military capacity to take something, it tries, versus a country that has a unfinished civil war, but beyond that has shown no territorial expansion tendencies, and we're claiming that the latter is where we're going to have to spend our resources in the short run. Again, Donald Trump is trading a misassessment of what's valuable and what looks good for where our true interests lie. That's why I don't like what he's doing.
Emily.
Oh, I was expecting that to go to Bob. I just think it's embarrassing. I think that he is embarrassing the United States. I think that he is kowtowing to Putin. I think that it's just very embarrassing to see him treat Zelensky the way he is. I'm not going to pretend that I'm extremely educated on this whole, you know, geopolitical conflict, unlike some people like the president and his lapdog. I don't pretend to understand things that I know really nothing about, but I do know that what he's doing is embarrassing. It's a bad look for America. He wants to to make America great again, and he's going to do that by withdrawing from the places where we actually need to be, where people actually need our help. This is what it means to be America. And then he – anyway, that's all I can really give on this situation.
I got you. Bob?
Sure. Here's what I'll say. He's the president. He was the one just elected a few months ago with an electoral college, a large electoral college margin, and winning the popular vote for the first time as a Republican since 1988. He's the guy we got. What I've heard in the last 20 minutes is opinion and speculation. This is, right, Emily, you just started with, I think, right? We don't know what he knows. We don't know what they know. We don't know what his end game is, or even if he has an end game. But the fact of the matter is, he's the guy we got. And you can sit here and foretell the future, which as far as I can tell, nobody has ever been able to do. Or you can see how the process plays out and look at the result. For the moment, I'm going to trust that he's the guy. Like, Bill, you know, I'm not going to defend everything the guy. I don't like what the guy says. I don't even like the guy. But he's the president. And he was elected, and everybody was, I think people were aware of where he was going to go on this. You know, you want to say he's a Putin puppet, that's fine. We heard that stuff for 8 years, and he still got an electoral college. He won every swing state and won the popular vote, even after 8 years of he's a Putin puppet. Okay, so, you know, knock yourself out. But he's the president, and this is what we got. And we can hope for the best. And but I do think he is effectively sending a message that American support can't be taken for granted by every country that we've been supporting. It doesn't mean we're not going to continue to support them in the future. It just means you got to step up, because we're not going to automatically jump there. I mean, that's how World War I started, with everybody jumping there because they were, you know, tied into these alliances, right? So, you know, I'm okay with that for now.
Hey, you know, Bob, first of all, he won the plurality of the vote, but not the majority of the.
I didn't say that. He said he won the popular vote.
Okay, he didn't win the popular vote. He won a plurality of the popular vote, not the majority of it. But let's be clear about what Donald Trump promised. So if everybody who voted for him, hey, look, you and I both know, I think, that when you vote for a candidate, you sort of take the better one or the lesser of two evils. But if you want to distill it down to everybody who voted for him signed up for his policy on Ukraine, Donald Trump is already an utter failure. How do I know that? Because Donald Trump promised that he would do this in one day before he was inaugurated. So he has not fulfilled even his promise to those who were duped by him.
That was Mark Whitman on the Roundtable Panel on Thursday, February 27th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable Panel The Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review. On Friday, February 28th, Joe was out and Sarah LaDuke hosted. She was joined by Albany County Legislator, Deputy Minority Leader, and former longtime Colony Town Board Member Paul Bergdorf, former EPA Regional Administrator Professor at Bennington College and President of Beyond Plastics, Judith Enck, and Professor of Economics at Siena College, Aaron Pasitti.
Let's discuss projected and confusion around EPA layoffs. This coverage from the New York Times. During his cabinet meeting this past Wednesday, so the day before yesterday, President Trump mentioned that Lee Zeldin, the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, intended to fire 65% of employees, an incision so deep that officials said it would hobble the EPA. Mr. Trump said Mr. Zeldin thinks he's going to be cutting 65% or so of the people from environmental. This is a quote from President Trump. And we're going to speed up the process, too, at the same time. A sentence that contains no information. Within minutes, managers at the agency said they received a White House memo telling them to prepare for mass layoffs. The memo, which was sent to leaders of multiple agencies, said that the federal government is, quote, costly, inefficient, and deeply in debt. It did not mention the 65% goal, but laid out steps for the EPA to prepare what is known for as a reduction in force, which would result in eliminating jobs. But hours later, an EPA official said Mr. Trump was referring to overall agency budget cuts and not a 65% reduction in personnel. The EPA has 15,123 full-time employees at the end of December. According to the latest budget, a reduction of 65% would mean the loss of nearly 10,000 jobs. Mrs. Owens-Powell said the administration had not been informed the union. The administration had not informed the union about its 65% goal, and that she had heard about it first from Mr. Trump on television. And Marie Owens-Powell is the president of the agency's biggest union, the American Federation of Government Employees. During his first term, Mr. Trump promised to eliminate the EPA in almost every form, leaving only tidbits, that's another quote, intact at the agency responsible for protecting the air and water from pollution. Myron Ebel, a longtime critic of the EPA who has led the agency transition team during Mr. Trump's first term, said 65% cut was a start. He said the EPA has largely fulfilled its mission and could be downgraded to an agency that monitors and assists state environmental agencies. Judith, we'll begin with you.
So, full disclosure, I worked at the EPA. I was the regional administrator during the Obama administration, and I saw firsthand what the EPA does. Can there be better efficiencies? Sure. But cutting either the overall budget or the staff by 65% is wildly irresponsible. And it's not just that scientists and engineers and lawyers and policy experts will be out of jobs. Many of them will be. But also, this is going to affect our day-to-day lives. And I just want to talk about what that would mean in the Capital District. First, we all remember the Hudson River PCB cleanup. A lot of PCBs have been removed from the Hudson River because of EPA. General Electric did not want to do this. They fought it tooth and nail. And the cleanup is not done. A lot of the PCBs have been dredged out, but there's a lot of monitoring. And wouldn't it be nice if someday we could go fishing in the Hudson and not have our fish contaminated with PCBs? We worked at EPA when I was there on PFOA contamination in Hoosick Falls, New York. Unfortunately, the state health department did not inform residents that they were drinking contaminated drinking water. It was EPA that stepped in because, you know, some Republicans will say you have state agencies, so you don't need EPA. But EPA provides really critical oversight. Another example is when I was at EPA, former Governor Andrew Cuomo wanted to snatch millions of dollars away from the Federal Clean Water Fund and use it to repair the Tappan Zee Bridge, later named the Mario Cuomo Bridge. It was EPA that had to step in and say, no, 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 those federal funds are for clean water, not for bridge repair. And then more broadly, you know, we don't talk a lot about acid rain, but for decades we had.
I've been saying is like the main environmental thing when I was a kid, and you never hear about it anymore.
Because of EPA. I mean, EPA and Northeastern State Attorneys General either regulated or sued coal-fired power plants in the Midwest. Their air pollution from their tall stacks were drifting into the Adirondacks, into the Catskills, causing acid rain. And that is a Clean Air Act victory. And then my final point is climate change. Lee Zeldin and the Trump administration is rolling back critical rules that would reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Climate change is here. We are already feeling the impacts. And greenhouse gases that are released into the atmosphere today last for decades. So you can't just flip the switch and say we're no longer going to be releasing greenhouse gases. We're going to invest in clean renewables. It'll take decades to recover from this. So the notion that they're going to cut either the number of staff or the full budget of EPA by 65% is a gift to polluters and reminds me so much of what was said publicly. Donald Trump invited a number of fossil fuel executives to Mar-a-Lago last year and actually said, give me $1 billion in campaign contributions and I'll take care of your interests. And I think that is at least somewhat motivating what's going on with this really irresponsible announcement by the administration.
Aaron? I think there's a broader story here about you know, the cuts at the EPA are just part of a broader program to, you know, make the government more efficient and run like a business. The problem with that approach is that the government's designed not to run like a business. Economists view government as providing necessary services that the private sector would not provide because they're either unprofitable, too costly, or with uncertain returns. So the whole concept that government should be run like a business is a fallacy because the government is designed to operate not like a business. What the U.S. government primarily – the way you can conceive of what the U.S. government does, it's an insurance company with an army. Two-thirds of all federal expenditures are on social insurance programs, primarily Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and national defense. And the reason they provide those programs is because no insurer – would insure elderly people because it's too costly and they would have to actually pay claims instead of denying them. No insurance company would insure poor people because they can't pay. And no private company would provide national defense because there's really no profitable way to do that. I mean, you can hire defense contractors, you know, to set up a Taco Bell inside the Green Zone in Baghdad, but that's fundamentally different than the entire defense infrastructure. So this whole idea that we can make government more efficient by cutting staff is really a way, as Judith pointed out at the end, to really just transfer power from regulators who are trying to preserve the public interest to private interests who contribute to different politicians' campaigns.
Paul Bergdorf.
Well, you know, I guess where you stand depends upon where you sit. There are many people in the United States that feel as though their government no longer represents their interests. And in any continuum of politics, there is the far left, there is the far right, and then there is the center. And I think this whole new coalition, historic realignment that elected Donald Trump is telling those on the left and quite candidly some of the people on the right that I would think are that I believe are a little far to the right that the correct place is somewhere in the middle. Now let's look at the EPA. First of all, the president made a statement. He got his 65%. He characterized it the wrong way. It is 65% of overall expenditures.
Which is even worse.
I'd like to finish. Is an aspirational target. But in the last year of Biden's administration, the EPA went up 8.5%. And I don't know what it went up the other 3%. So maybe we're bringing the EPA back to where it was when Biden started. That's a possibility. But I think one of the things that has happened now is, unlike in 2016, is Trump has secretaries and commissioners that he trusts. And I believe that Lee Zeldin is going to bring the EPA back to its core mission, and we're not going to give $2 million to Stacey Abrams for a not-for-profit that she started less than a year ago so that she can do climate studies in the South. There is all sorts of waste across our federal government. I'm not going to sit here and read off the hundreds of AID programs that actually the great middle of America is rebelling against. We've gone too far with transgender. We've gone too far with DEI. And people want the government not to be social engineers, but to form, to, they want them to concentrate on the core elements of government. Pete Hegseth at the military, smart guy. People may not think he is, but he's Harvard and Princeton educated guy. He, before Dodge gets there, called his generals in and said, give me every weapon system that was forced on you by Congress that you want to get rid of because it's no longer consistent with supporting warfighters. This is a tremendous opportunity for us to make dollars at the Department of Defense more acute and painstaking. But that's just some of the examples.
Proposed and confusingly in the news discussed cutbacks at the EPA, and we ended before the BBC News with a first sort of statement from Paul Bergdorf, and I'll go now to Judith and we'll run the room again.
Well, whether the president intends to cut EPA by 65% overall or by 65% staff, either are quite terrible. And it's not about left or right. Everyone deserves clean drinking water. Everyone deserves clean air. We have to have our Adirondack lakes and Catskills free of acid rain. And this is not political. This is basic environmental regulation and environmental protection. And as we know from the acid rain example, New York State could do a good job driving down air pollution at coal-fired power plants. But we have a lot of air pollution coming in from other states. We have a climate crisis on our hands. This is not something in the future. This is something that is here today. It's affecting agriculture. It's affecting tourism. It's really affecting health. And with everything we know about pollution, to be reducing the impact of EPA is really irresponsible. Until the first Trump administration, every environmental regulation was strengthened over time because we learned more about the science. The largest office at the EPA is Office of Research and Development. It's the scientists. And they're telling us that maybe microplastics in our brains, in our bloodstream, in our kidneys are not good for our health, and we need to do something about it. The other point I want to make is that so much of the EPA budget flows to the states. It's to upgrade sewage treatment plants. It's to provide clean drinking water. And a lot of the EPA programs save money for Americans. You and I pay less at the pump when you fill up your car, if it's not an electric car, because cars have become more fuel efficient. That's because of the Clean Air Act and improvements in fuel efficiency standards. One of the biggest uses of electricity in your home is probably your refrigerator. A refrigerator you buy today is a lot more efficient than what you bought 10 years ago, saving you on your utility bill. So it is, it's just a false narrative, Paul, that this is left or right and we're getting to the center. This is about economics. This is about public health. And it's about the most basic level of environmental protection, which will be compromised severely if the EPA budget or staff number is cut by 65%. The state cannot pick up the gap.
Mike writes into panel at WAMC.org and says, this is a critical time for climate change. Virtually all scientists agree time is not on our side. And what message does cutting EPA funding by so much send to the rest of the world? Why spend billions on SpaceX instead of saving our own planet?
And the Trump administration pulled out of the Paris Climate Accord. What I often hear when I advocate for policies to reduce greenhouse gas emissions is, oh, this has to happen at the international level. China has a lot of emissions, which is true. Okay, so at the international level, we had the Paris Climate Accord. And the first Trump administration pulled out, Biden put us back in, and now Trump administration is removing us from any international cooperation on climate change.
Paul?
Well, there is an evolution going on in climate change right now, and I am not a climate change denier, but I believe that the country needs a transitional strategy to get between where we are now and where we have less carbon emissions. The problem is that the folks that are designing policy will tell you the world is ending tomorrow and design regulations as if it were, but it's not. Look at what's happening in our own New York State. We have the Climate Action Council. All these things are supposed to happen by 2030. The percentage of electric cars is supposed to be something. And everyone is now acknowledging, with the Democratic policymakers last, that this is just absolutely unattainable. They are projecting utility rates in New York City and across the state that are unfathomable because all of the mandated programs are supporting wind and solar and are costing billions and billions of dollars. Yet the world as a whole, if you look to Europe, they're not depending on wind and solar anymore. They're a node. They are going to baseline power. They're going to nuclear plants. There's been a revision across the world in energy policy. So to sit back and say we have to do everything today when China and India and Brazil and Russia are adding coal plants by the hundreds, so there is no world consensus about reducing greenhouse gas. If anybody could tell me with what we've done today how that needle has moved worldwide, I'm not sure that the United States taxpayer by themselves should be aspirationally trying to save the world by themselves. And there is an evolution in even in Europe where we're going away from renewables and back towards nuclear power.
Judith.
Wind, solar, geothermal is cheaper than fossil fuels and much better for our health. Paul is right. The Hochul administration is walking back some climate commitments, which I'm highly critical of. The opposition is led not by average citizens, but by fossil fuel companies who sell gas and they sell oil and they don't want to transition. New York State, definitely imperfect, but you compare it to the federal administration. You know what the Trump administration did last week? There are thousands of electric car charging stations at federal facilities. The Trump administration ordered that they be disabled. They're already built. People are already using them. What is the point of disabling electric car charging stations? The point is the administration is in the pocket of big oil, which, by the way, if DOGE was serious about cutting federal waste, fraud, and abuse, they should be looking at the multi-billion dollar fossil fuel subsidies. Much bigger subsidies than what renewable energy companies get and what individual homeowners get who want to have more energy efficiency in their own homes. The Trump administration is sending us off the cliff. We are not even close to a perfect climate change policy at the state or federal level, but at least the state has the good sense to adopt some policies to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, which, by the way, makes energy and transportation fuels more affordable for average New Yorkers. That's why the governor is supporting congestion pricing, which the president is supposed to repeal. Who wants more congestion in New York City and less money for mass transit? The Trump administration.
That was Judith Enck on the Roundtable panel on Friday, February 28th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable.
This has been this week's Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.